This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Lin Din. He is an author and poet, and has a series out called Postcards from the End of America, and he also writes for The Ends Review. Lin, it's great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
So this series, Postcards from the End of America, it's a photo travel journal that you did, and you chronicle, it's very artistically done, but the overall theme is you chronicleize the decline of America.
Yeah, I started this in 2010, Robert, just traveling around, taking photos and talking to people. It took a while for me to figure out how to do this because, you know, when you go into a strange town, what do you do? I mean, who do you meet? And since I've always been drawn to cheap bars, you know, I decided that that's what I would do. I would go to wherever and just find the cheapest bar and just walk in. And usually people would talk to me because, you know, people are friendly, especially in those kind of places. So the focus was on how people were surviving, you know, economically. And I was convinced even back then that the country was in deep trouble, that, you know, economically for the at least the lower half, that people were really struggling, and it was getting worse year by year. And so I would talk to people, and you know, my suspicions were always confirmed because everybody was complaining about how they were doing. Even the bartenders, you know, less people were drinking, they were tipping less, they were putting less money into the jukebox, and so on. And you know, because I didn't have a whole lot of money, I still don't. You know, I would take these long bus trips or train trips, and usually sleep on them, you know, maybe for a week at a time, maybe 2 weeks at a time. And that got me all over the country. And so the result was my book, Postcards from the End of America.
You originally came here from Vietnam. What was your initial impression of America? And at what point in your life did you start to notice that there was something wrong?
Well, I came here when I was 11, so I was just a child. And interestingly, just 2 days ago, I was talking to a friend here. You know, I'm talking to you from Saigon, you know, where I was born. I was talking to a friend here about one of my first impressions of the United States was how people were throwing food away. Because, you know, in my school, all the kids were giving all the basic food groups, you know, the orange juice, the milk, the vegetable, the meat, whatever. And a lot of them didn't want to eat all that, but they had to take it because it was on the tray. And they would throw like a whole can of orange juice into the trash can, you know, a whole can of milk. And that struck me as just bizarre, you know, that food that was not just uneaten and thrown away, but that it had to be given out because the law required that each child had to be served all five food groups or whatever. So, you know, the kind of waste and excess that was available in the United States struck me as just incomprehensible. But then I got used to it. And, you know, and then I started to throw food away because it was like, whatever, it's just food, right? But once you start paying for your food, you realize that, no, you know, it still costs a lot of money. It's still, you know, you still have to earn the food. And, you know, people are not doing well even then. So, and I think since... all the factories being moved overseas, you know, outsourcing. The American economy has really gone into a nosedive. And, you know, there's so much talk about the recovery and all that, but it's just nonsense. And you know that as well as I do.
And, yeah, there's all this propaganda. when Obama was in power, you heard the Democratic pundits saying the economy's improving, and now that Trump's in power, the Republicans are doing the same thing. But pretty much since most of the 21st century, we've been in this massive economic decline.
Yeah, sure. And the statistics are just phony. You know, the unemployment statistics, the inflation figure, all these figures are just lies, and the people know it. Unless you have a very smug, good job somewhere, and you just pretend to not notice these things. But I think most ordinary people, you know, whenever there's a story on Yahoo, for example, on the improving economy, all the comments are howling, you know, are screaming at how phony all the facts are. So, you know, you read the comments and you realize people know full well that the press is lying to us all day. Every article is a lie.
What would you say are the core issues for America's economic decline? You mentioned manufacturing jobs going overseas. That's one of them. What are some other issues? Is Wall Street a major factor?
Oh, sure. Sure. Wall Street is a major factor. You know, the wealth discrepancy between the richest and the poorest. But also, America has to go into decline because of the global competition. Once China entered the picture, as a manufacturing power, the United States could no longer compete or could no longer expect to live on the same level that it did, you know, with a factory worker making $20 an hour, $30 an hour, and having a nice house in a suburb. So Americans have to get used to economic decline as a fact of life, because and that's the only way we can compete. That's why Trump cannot bring those factories back unless Americans are willing to live on a lower standard. And so far, that hasn't happened, but yet it's happening anyway because they don't have a choice. You know, grown children are staying with their parents. You know, college-graduated adults are moving back into their parents' home. So Americans are already being forced to live like the rest of the world, you know. Here in Vietnam, it's not hardly unusual to find, say, 10 people in a house, you know, three generations. But Americans are not used to that. You know, we expect to have our own rooms, our own television, our own everything, and it's just not going to happen. So so that's a very hard reality to swallow, but I don't see any way around it.
People putting out all kinds of different economic solutions. Some people are talking about things like the basic income. Do you think there are economic solutions, or do we just have to accept that we're in perpetual decline?
And, you know, actually, we are getting more than we deserve because America is still the empire. We still have a lot of leverage, a lot of power. So people are still sending us stuff, and we're still paying with money that is made out of nothing. You know, we are in debt to every other country that we trade with, which is bizarre. You know, so in a sense, America is actually technically poorer than Vietnam because it owes Vietnam money. Vietnam doesn't owe the United States any money, you know, but the United States owes a poor country like Vietnam money because of our status as the empire. You know, we have the leverage to demand trades, uneven trades. So actually, we are actually poorer than we are right now. So we are actually the poorest country on earth because, you know, we are the most indebted country on earth. You know, if your credit card is you keep running up your credit card, then you are poor. It doesn't matter how much stuff you have. So that is a very harsh reality that America will have to come to terms with the very next stock market collapse, because the stock market is given the illusion that everything is fine. And, you know, it's also convincing the rest of the world that America is fine, because from the outside, for example, from Vietnam, United States looks fine because of all the propaganda, you know, that we pump out. You know, across the street from where I'm talking to you right now, there's a movie house, and the American movies show all these, you know, images of a very affluent and luxurious and happy United States. And people here believe it because they haven't been there.
Primarily why so many people from countries like China and Vietnam want to come to the United States?
That's one reason, but also the rich Chinese are also coming to the United States. You know, because why not? If they can use their money to buy real estate in the San Francisco Bay Area, then why wouldn't they do it? You know, so the rich Vietnamese are also wanting to buy land in the United States, send their kids to the United States, you know, because it they don't lose anything by it. You know, they're still doing business here, and they're hedging their bets in a way, because in many of them don't trust the governments here either. So, you know, they can make their money here, send their children to the United States to college or even to high school, and buy land there, buy property there, because, you know, United States is still a very attractive option if you have money. So it's not just the poor that wants to come to the United States, also the rich. And I don't know, you're calling me from the West Coast, I'm, you know, maybe California, but the real estate prices around the Bay Area is out of control. So that,
yeah, they're insane. That,
yeah, they're insane. And it's mostly because of Asian money, you know. So, you know, the stereotype of the immigrant as this poor, downtrodden person is not necessarily true. You also have very rich people coming in and disrupting the economy for everybody, including previous generations of immigrants, you know, including poor immigrants. So the poor immigrants and the poor Americans, native-born Americans in the Bay Area cannot afford to live there anymore. That's why you see help wanted signs everywhere. In the fast food restaurants, you know, in the low-end job market. And, you know, I know this because, you know, I travel around, I see it firsthand. So, you know, you walk around, you see, you know, help wanted signs at Burger King, McDonald's, because the people who make that kind of wages can't afford to live in Cupertino or San Jose.
Did you do a series where you visited the Silicon Valley region in San Francisco?
Yeah, I was a visiting professor at Berkeley for a month, so that gave me some time. And also I have family in the Bay Area. You know, I spent a year in high school in San Jose, so I have a lot of familiarity with the Bay Area. And it is a nice contrast to my home base in Philadelphia, or my former home base of Philadelphia, because Philadelphia is pretty blue-collar, pretty poor. And you know, San Jose and the Bay Area is a fairly affluent, it's very affluent area. So it's like this bubble. You know, there are a few bubbles in the United States that are looking very, you know, very gorgeous. You know, Washington, D.C. is one. Manhattan is another. San Francisco Bay Area is another. And, you know, the rest of the country don't look anything like that. So,
do you think mass immigration is a major factor for growing income inequality?
Well, here's the funny thing. In Asia, no one would say, I believe in open borders. Okay? In Asia, people are very committed to maintaining a national identity. Every country you go to, okay, and even regions, okay, specific regions want to maintain its identity. Only in the West, okay, basically only in white countries do you hear people saying, oh, borders don't matter, we can have open borders. But if you think about this for a second, it doesn't make sense, because no country can afford to absorb endless immigration, okay. And some of the people who are opposing this are actually immigrants themselves in the United States. Okay, I mean, literally yesterday I talked to another Vietnamese friend, and I was saying, for example, on my street there are 17 houses in Saigon. Let's say a black family moves in. Okay, now the rest of the neighborhood, you know, may be able to absorb that family, but that family needs time to learn Vietnamese culture, to get along, to learn how to deal with the, you know, his new neighbors. But if every year there's a new black family moving in onto the street, then there's bound to be tension. Okay, so that's, in microcosm, is what's happening in the West. And people who are complaining about this are instantly charged with racism. And I don't think that's fair. And I'm saying that as a non-white person. Okay, so because, you know, like I just gave you an example of what would happen in Saigon if a black family moves onto my street every year, a new black family.
Yeah, I mean, even if 10 million Chinese people moved to Vietnam, there would be tension.
Sure, of course, of course. So, you know, I just went to Cambodia, and the Vietnamese are flooding into Cambodia. Why? Because there's 96 million Vietnamese, and there's only, I think, 15 million Cambodians. So, you know, it's just a population pressure pushing the poorest Vietnamese into Cambodia, okay? So there's
so
a
Cambodia
lot of tension over
is
there.
Significantly poorer than Vietnam.
Poorer and emptier, okay? Vietnam is so overpopulated. But I'm saying, what kind of Vietnamese immigrants would want to go to Cambodia? Because if you go there, you're likely to be even poorer than your average Cambodian, you know? I mean, of course, there are rich Vietnamese in Cambodia, But there are many, many very dirt poor Vietnamese living in Cambodia who are at the bottom of a Cambodian society. And they go there because they are so desperate in Vietnam itself. And it's causing a lot of tension naturally. So, you know, there's been outbreaks of violence in the past against Vietnamese immigrants in Cambodia. So, you know, no one would want to see that again, but, you know, there is tension there, and who knows what's going to happen in the future. So there is a lot of complaints and even fairly hysterical rhetorics in Cambodia about Vietnam being overtaken, Cambodia being overtaken by Vietnamese immigrants. But another danger in Cambodia, the Chinese are moving in because they have the power to do so. They're moving factories in, you know, they're buying land there. Some of the most prominent buildings in Phnom Penh are built by the Chinese and to serve the Chinese, like the casino. The casino is filled with Chinese and it's owned by a Malaysian Chinese. And so, you know, invasion doesn't mean like a military moving in. There are many ways you can take over a country. And without sounding too hyperbolic, I would say the Chinese are doing that to Cambodia.
Has there been a history of resentment towards the Chinese diaspora in Southeast Asia? I know there were some incidences, I think it was Indonesia, where there was actually violent riots.
Oh yeah, sure. And in Vietnam, in every country. And I'm speaking, you know, my stepmother's Chinese, my wife's stepfather's Chinese. So, I have Chinese in the family, you know. There's always been resentment because China, again, you know, we talk about population pressure. China is this huge country that always want to export people. You know, they always have too many. They've been having too many people for a very long time. So their people always have been spilling over into neighboring countries for centuries. So, and that caused tension. So some of these Chinese assimilate over time. But it takes, but most of them still maintain their identity, even centuries later. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm saying that's only natural from the Chinese perspective. But from the Vietnamese perspective, it causes tension, and it still causes tension. And I'm not saying people are, you know, ready to kill each other at any moment. People get along. People try to accommodate. But you don't want to push this tension to such an extreme that violence breaks out, and it has broken out all over Asia in regard to the Chinese immigration into these places. And again, like the Vietnamese moving into Laos, into Cambodia, caused the same tension. You know, immigration always caused tension, okay? That's just a fact, okay? I mean, I'm not saying that's a nice thing to happen, but when you have an alien population among your midst, it's going to cause tension. And, you know, immigrants do, to a degree, try to accommodate, try to assimilate, just as I did when I was in the United States. You know, I became an American. And, you know, when I wrote my articles, I wrote as an American. I didn't write as a Vietnamese-American person trying to defend Vietnamese interests, because most of my friends are non-Vietnamese in the United States. So, you know, I try to speak as just, a working class, a poor American talking for other Americans.
And you've also traveled around Europe. Do you see the same trend happening with the whole migrant crisis in Europe, especially Germany?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was invited to teach for 5 months in Leipzig, and I have never seen a country with a weaker sense of national identity. You know, that any country I've visited, you know, has a stronger sense of itself than the current state of Germany. My students would say something like, well, I don't even feel German, you know. They say, well, you know, we've always been a nation of immigrants, which is true. Every country, Vietnam itself has been a nation of immigrants. But they would say, well, just bring them in because they are an asset to the economy. They, you know, they will benefit us. You know, they do not want to assert their German identity. But the poorer Germans, and especially the Germans in the eastern part of the country, can be more vocal about that. And those
is
are the Germans.
Is it Leipzig in the East Germany?
Yeah. Leipzig and Dresden has these demonstrators. They meet every Monday. Okay, they are the anti-immigration group.
Is this the Pegida? They're called Pegida.
Yeah, Pegida and Pegida meets. It starts in Dresden and it has spread to Leipzig. But the interesting thing is, you know, when I first got to Leipzig, I wanted to see this demonstration to see what it was all about, but I could not get to it because the police were blocking every road leading to this little square that had the demonstration. So in a sense, it wasn't a public demonstration. It was just the Pegida people coming to the square and making their speeches, and the public had no access to it because the cops were blocking every road to this little square, and they had a good reason to, because the leftist elements were trying to get in there to fight them, okay? And the leftist elements, some of them were my students. I mean, so they were dressed in black. They were trying to sneak in. They were trying to find every little alley or whatever, but they were blocked every time. So you had this weekly demonstration and counter demonstration, and in between were hundreds of policemen. Okay, a huge show of force to prevent these two groups from fighting each other. And, I would say that it was the leftists that were trying to beat up the rightists. It wasn't the other way around, although that's what you hear from outside Germany, that you have these neo-Nazis that go in berserk, you know. And so what it does is every Monday, downtown is shut down because people cannot function. The stores, the shops cannot operate normally. So it's a huge disruption. And when I left, it was still going on. And I don't know if it's still going on now, but I predicted that, you know, Germans will fight each other on the streets, you know, would even kill each other over this immigration problem.
So it's because more Germans versus Germans than Germans versus migrants.
Yeah, yeah. There were no migrants on either side. You know, it was basically Germans against Germans. And I think the anti-immigration sentiment is stronger in East Germany because they had to go through communism. It was basically Russian. They were subjugated by the Russians. You know, all the Eastern Bloc countries, all those former communist countries, have a stronger sense of their national identity now because they had to revive it. They had to rescue it. You know, they had to suffer decades of an alien ideology. You know, so. They have a stronger sense that they need to protect, like, Polish identity, Hungarian identity, Czech identity, and et cetera, you know. So in the West, you know, they had all these decades of propaganda, brainwashing, that, you know, that borders don't matter, that multiculturalism is the future. And so they go along with that. So, you know, in a sense, they've been brainwashed by this American propaganda that they don't need to protect French identity, Spanish identity, etc. But in the Eastern Bloc, you know, they are resisting, you know, demands that they accept Muslim immigrants into their country. And I say this without any animosity towards any Muslim whatsoever. Okay, I think they are the victims in the bigger scheme of things because they are being attacked by the Israeli American coalition. You know, their societies have been destroyed. So that they are forced out of their homelands and into Europe. And I think it's all done by design. Okay, so the Israeli-American coalition destroy one Muslim society after another, and most of these societies that are destroyed are actually religiously fanatical. So, you know,
a country like Syria, which was under the Assad regime, was secular and tolerant.
Yeah.
Then the United States and Saudi Arabia started sure. backing all these jihadis.
Yeah, and you know, people forget that when the United States and Israel destroy Iraq, Syria took in hundreds of thousands of Iraqi refugees. So they did not export refugees, they absorbed refugees from Iraq. And now, you know, because we are trying to destroy their country, they're spilling over into Europe and into Turkey. And I visit Turkey, and I saw how wretched they are on the streets of Istanbul, begging on the streets. These are regular people that had homes, had businesses, are now living on the streets of Istanbul. And Americans are oblivious to that. And we are responsible for that. We're directly responsible for that. And where is the American left, you know, that is supposed to be so anti-war, you know? It is outrageous. There is concern about transgender bathroom rights and all these other issues, and not genocide, you know, war crimes committed in their name with their tax money.
They were during the Bush era, but since Obama, and even now that Trump's president, everything is, with the left is Trump's a racist, Trump's a misogynist, but they're saying nothing. The left is, the whole left-wing anti-war movement has become pathetic.
Yeah, yeah, it's entirely manipulated, you know. And, you know, before Trump won, I actually predicted, you know, because when everybody else was saying that they're going to sabotage Trump, they're going to not let Trump win, they're going to assassinate him even before the election, all this nonsense, I say, don't worry, they're going to, he is their man because he's most useful for them. And, you know, there are still people who don't believe me, who think I'm talking out of my ass. But, you know, look at how useful Trump is, you know, because he is a useful target for the left. And he gives false hope to the frustrated working poor, mostly white working poor, you know. So, you know, he is a kind of a decoy. You know, he takes people away from who are the real culprits in our decline, in our destruction.
Because if you look at his policies, the main things that he's accomplished are tax cuts for corporations and the ultra wealthy. But he's done very little to help his original core populist message.
Yeah, he's done nothing. He hasn't fulfilled any of his promises. I mean, he hasn't built the wall. Of course, that's not going to be built. I mean, how are you going to get Mexico to build a wall, too? You know, that's not going to happen. And, you know, tension with Russia is worse than even during Obama's time. And the Syria war is still going on. You know, all these things, right? So, you know, the Russiagate nonsense is not so much to bring down Trump. It was never meant for that. It's to demonize Russia. And so, you know, he's going along with all this nonsense. So he's very useful for them. So, you know, the left is fixated on this man as if the United States problems can be solved with the elimination of Trump, which is nonsense, you know. And like you say, Trump policies is a continuation of Obama's. So, superficially, they're very different, but it's still the same warmongering, pro-Israel, self-destructive policies that we've been on for a while now.
Do you reject all these political labels like liberal or conservative or progressive?
Well, I tend not to use them, but you know, I never use them in my articles. But the notion of progress is something I find very problematic, to say the least, because people think that for example, this belief that we're going to go to Mars soon, you know, flying cars and all that, you know, spaceships going to Mars, and it's all nonsense. I mean, I think getting back to my earlier statement is that we better get used to a kind of regression, you know, but that doesn't mean that it's negative, okay? Because there's a lot to regain, there's a lot to relearn. And, you know, for example, being in Vietnam here, there is a core set of values, okay, not all of which I agree with. I mean, I find a lot of problems with Vietnamese society, too. But these things allow Vietnamese to be Vietnamese, okay? So Americans need to relearn what it means to be Americans. And I don't mean like some kind of ethnic identity, but, you know... For example, you know, it used to be you used to need congressional confirmation approval to go to war, and now American presidents can routinely go to war without, you know, bothering with convincing Congress of anything. You know, so you know, that's a core American value that's been lost. You know, and our notion of individual rights, privacy, all those things. You know, I mean, the United States was not built on an ethnic basis, but on a set of values. So those values have been chipped away and basically disappear. So, you know, we need to regain that, okay? So we need to rebuild our communities. And those are just human values that need to be relearned, okay? There is no population more alienated than the United States. And, you may disagree with me, but I travel all over, and I find everywhere else people have a better sense of where they are, you know, and they have a better enjoyment of their neighbors, of their friends, of their neighbors, you know. Americans are so isolated, and, you know, I'm sitting in some bar in Philadelphia, and I can barely talk, because, you know, the TV's on, the music is on, you know, so I'm screaming, and people cannot focus, they cannot concentrate, you know, their minds are just destroyed, basically, you know. So, you know, we need to shut down the distractions, you know, the propaganda, the corporate propaganda that's pumped into our brains daily, you know, and you see this in children, you know, you see this in younger people, you know, they're constantly fixated on their smartphone, their stupid phone, and, you know, they cannot hear you, you know, they cannot hear five or six sentences in a row because their minds can no longer function properly. So when I say regression, it's a return. I don't mean like, you know, Trump's promise to make America great again. We're not going to get the big cars from the 50s and all that. But we need to relearn how to be human and to be Americans in the best sense, okay? And not all these stupid slogans and the big flags, you know, and the jets flying over the stadium and all that nonsense.
But you wrote about the alley culture in Southeast Asia, zoning laws, and nomadic Americans. Do you think American urban planning with the suburban sprawl plays a major role in people becoming disconnected from one another?
Sure. I mean, it's how we lay out our streets. And, you know, James Howard Kunstler is a great person to consult for that.
I've interviewed him.
Oh, yeah, for those insights. But the media, too, you know. I mean, you know, even from when I arrived in the United States in 1975, until now I can see a progressive, you know, the pollution, the media pollution. I've seen it gotten worse and worse. So, you know, so, I mean... Before, you didn't see people walking down the street with a personal headphone, you know, so that they're in their private universe, even when they're among people, you know, because that wasn't an option. You didn't have that, you know. Now, you know, I'm on a train, I'm on a bus, and people are blocked from their immediate environment. You know, I could be sitting next to a person on a bus and have no contact with him for several hours because he's on his headphone. He doesn't want to be bothered. And I don't think that's healthy at all. I think it's only insanity. So I think Americans need to recognize this. But if they don't want to, I mean, what are you going to do? If people prefer to be insane, you know, so they fixate on pornography, you know, on their own little universe all day long.
In other countries you visited, is it more socially acceptable to start up a conversation with a stranger?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think so because there's a space for it, you know, even in Europe, you know. I spent 2 years in Italy, and before dinner, every day, there's a passeggiata, which means that you hang out in the square. You know, in the bigger city, maybe that's not so so prevalent. But in my little town, you know, everybody went to the square in front of the church, you know, and they would hang out for, you know, close to an hour. You know, so the old people would stand in this corner, the old men would stand in this corner and talk, you know. The teenagers walk around, flirt, the kids would play, and it's just wonderful just to sit there to be among, you know, your fellow human beings, you know, and the immigrants were there too. It's not just for Italians, you know, you see the Moroccans, you see the Albanians, you know, and I mean, you saw, you were there, you would see me and my wife, we were Vietnamese, we were perfectly welcome into that. So, you know, you need the space for that, and you need the mentality for that, and, you know, and the United States it's almost impossible. You know, you have these suburban developments, you know, which are strictly for sleeping. You know what I'm saying? I think you need mixed use zoning laws so that, you know, you have commercial. In England, for example, you may have a pub right in the middle of the neighborhood. In the United States, you cannot have a bar right in the middle of a suburban neighborhood, most of them, because, you know, it needs to be removed, you know. So, ideally, you should not have to get into a car to do the basics of daily lives. Okay, things need to be immediately accessible physically, so that you know you can do things, you can mingle, and if you have to get in a car to get a beer, then you're in deep trouble already. Okay.
Do you think that contributes a lot to the problems, psychological problems like depression and drug addiction? With this whole issue of a social isolation caused by a lot of different factors that you mentioned?
Yeah, sure. And the drugs that people are taking are not social drugs. You know, they're not drugs that make you want to go out and hang out with people. They're drugs that make you want to withdraw so that you're in your little corner. So, you know, the opioid epidemic is you know, I think last year there were like 65,000 people dead from opioid alone. And that's thanks to our good medical care that saved a lot of them, you know, because if we had a kind of a shaky medical emergency system, then maybe twice that number would have died. You know, I mean, I personally know people who want to die from drugs. You know, I mean, but I talked to a guy who keeps taking more drugs so he could die, but he hasn't died yet because every time he ODs, somebody would save him.
Do you think we need a nationalized healthcare in this country?
Oh yeah, sure. You know, I mean, just for the basics, because I mean, it's already available all over Europe, and you know, it's less costly, and you know, it's I mean, Americans are already paying too much for everything, so just for the basics, yeah, absolutely. You know, no, not nothing. I mean, you know, people say, oh, socialism a lot, but I mean, you know, we already having a kind of an you know, if you're hurt, you already run to the emergency room, so you're already being taken care of in the United States anyway, except that you're getting billed for like $20,000 the next day, you know. So in a sense, people already using a kind of safety net, a medical safety net, by running to the emergency room, okay, except that, you know, their financial life is ruined forever.
And as far as social spending goes, we're not really investing in our infrastructure. If you compare our airports and rail systems, they're really pathetic to what they have in Europe and Asia.
Oh yeah, and Americans do not. And it's interesting that Trump pointed that out, that American airports are in very sad shape. You know, and unfortunately, most Americans do not travel enough to realize that how far we have fallen behind. You know, so you know, they always stridently trying to convince themselves and others that you know USA number one, but it's just not true anymore. Okay. Most of our cities are in very bad shape, you know, and even the downtown, the nice areas are not that impressive anymore. So,
what are some of your observations on urban planning in Asian cities, both in Southeast Asia and the wealthier cities like Hong Kong?
Well, again, Americans need space around them. Okay. So even in a city like Detroit, you know, in the city itself, there's grass around every house. And I think that's totally unnecessary. You know, Americans don't want anybody above them, below them. You know, they don't want to share a wall or a ceiling or a floor with anybody. And I think that has to change because, you know, it's just impractical to live that way. It's just, you know, it's wasteful. It's socially isolating. And, you know, but, you know, we are so used to that, you know, that we don't want to, you know, we don't want to bother with the neighbors, but so that has to change. But you know, it wasn't that long ago that Americans too could accommodate, you know, living in close proximity to a lot of people. So that definitely has to change, you know. And the dependence on the car allows that kind of layout, you know. For example, you cannot take a train from say Austin to San Antonio. Which is absurd, you know. I mean, the last time I checked when I was there, you could not take that because I tried to take a train from Austin, and I look up and there was no way to do that, you know, because people were driving back and forth. You know, you cannot take a train from Albuquerque to Santa Fe, which is absurd, you know. But you know, some people say, well, we are so spread out, you know, we have to use the car. But I don't believe that's true because in the past we had a better train service, passenger train service system, so that has to come back, you know. I know Europe is a lot more compact, Asia is a lot more dense, so people use public transportation more readily, but Americans will need to restore, you know, public transportation to move forward. I don't think we have a choice, because I don't think we can afford to own a car and drive it by ourselves every day much longer anyway.
I was talking to a guest who lived in Korea. And he lived in this complex, which it was like, they were like 40-story skyscrapers, and it was really dense, but he said they had like a strong sense of community there, and all their amenities were within like that one complex.
Sure. And, you know, in Asia, you see people mingling, you know, eating, you know, sharing tables even, you know. They're not as disturbed by the physical touch of a stranger, you know, and so you know, it's just a whole different mindset, you know. I'm not saying it's always you know, in Saigon right now, you see the richer people trying to isolate themselves American style, you know, with big gates, big walls, you know, and residential neighborhoods only, you know, because they look into America and they're trying to live like Americans. But I don't think that's the future anyway.
Yeah, so I even see the same trend with Asian immigrants to the United States. A lot of wealthy Chinese immigrants want to live in these big McMansions.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, I mean, what wealth allows you to do that. And also, you know, they look into America. A lot of these developments in Asia have American names, for example. English American names, you know.
And you're talking about single-family homes. You're not talking about the high-rise developments.
Yeah, single-family homes. Yeah, because if the people who had money here, some of them are trying to isolate themselves, you know, to pretend they're in the United States or something. But that's still a very small minority. And as soon as they hit the streets, as soon as they are in the city, they still have to live in the Vietnamese way anyway. So, but again, I don't think that's the future for anybody in Asia or United States. I think with the next economic collapse, it's going to affect the whole world anyway. Okay. Going back in time in a way is going to be fairly universal. As you know, so this adjustment to a simpler, less technical, advanced way of life is going to be a fairly universal. And you know, maybe I'm just echoing Kunstler here, but I believe that's true.
Are there societies, a place like Singapore is technologically advanced, but it works because it's a lot more compact?
Well, they have these fairly depressing looking high rises, you know, that from afar looks almost Eastern European, you know, during the communist days, you know. But if you get closer to them, they have a food court inside them, they have amenities nearby, so there's still community life, you know. And they have the hallway, actually, that has to be shared, you know, it's designed that way. So, you know, the kids play in the hallways, you know, in the corridors, you know. So and they intersperse the different ethnic groups. You know, they have three major ethnic groups: the Malays, the Indians, and the Chinese. So they make sure that there's no like strictly Chinese building or strictly Indian building. So you know, yeah, it sounds like social planning. It sounds like, you know, top down, you know, government control. But they do it that way to facilitate you know, people dealing with each other. You know, in that way, they don't have a choice. You know, they have a mixed race society that is very dense, so people have to get along with each other. But the balance is maintained. See, this is an important point to make. It's still predominantly Chinese, and it's been that way for a while. I don't think it's going to change in the future because, you know, the Chinese want to keep the power they have. So yes, the Indians are represented in some high official posts, but it's still a Chinese society. But like I say, you know, the food court is a Singaporean's institution. You know, you go into there and you might have like 25 vendors selling all different types of food, and people sit in the middle. So it's like a mall food court, except where there's no mall, and people share tables, and it's very festive whenever you go into a Singaporean food court. And interestingly, you almost never see a white face in there because you know, I guess white people are just not used to that kind of eating, you know, among so many strangers, and maybe the food also may not agree with them totally. So, and you know, when Americans travel, when white people travel, when, you know, they tend to gravitate toward the whitest part of town. In Saigon, there's like a three or four streets that cater to white people, to Americans and Europeans. So it's interesting that people come to Vietnam and they don't go into the neighborhoods; they stay in the white, little pocket, you know, and because that's familiar to them. But it's also exotic enough because it's still Vietnam, so for them that's weird enough, right? Because you know, it's still chaotic, it's still crowded, you know, it's still Vietnamese in a way. But they hear American music, they eat their pizza, they eat their burritos, you know, they drink the American beer, American whiskey or whatever, and they go home. So you know, when people travel, they see not so much, you know, the hardcore reality of any country, but this caused several problems. They come back and think everybody else wants to be American, you know, because they go into these places And they assume that, well, you know, Vietnam is just a very poor version of America, a very kind of corrupt version of America. Thailand the same, Cambodia the same, Singapore, whatever. Everywhere they go, they see echoes of America, except for it's not convincing enough. So they think that the rest of the world are just trying to be Americans. But, it is very superficial, believe me, because at the bottom, people are still themselves. Singaporeans are Singaporeans. Vietnamese are Vietnamese. I was just in Thailand last week. You know, at no point did I think that I was in Vietnam, much less America, although there was a bit of English in use, especially in the one downtown mall they had. Everywhere else, there was very little English, except for on T-shirts, you know, maybe some stupid T-shirts. But it was, you know, all the little details from people's postures, people's demeanors, the tones of speech, the little amulets on the wall, you know, to ward off evil spirits. All the little stuff is strictly Thai, you know, and it wasn't even Vietnamese, you know. So people have a very clear sense of who they are and what they need to do. And I think Americans need to return to that.
We were talking about the whole theme of nationalism. And when people think of nationalism, they think of culture and ethnicity. But then this ties in with the economic angle, because America is a very individualistic society. And if people think of themselves as just individuals, as opposed to being part of a collective national identity, they're less likely to want to invest in infrastructure and support economic policies that will benefit the nation.
Well, we also have a kind of unthinking nationalism, you know, like this support the troops kind of nonsense, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't matter where they sent to.
A kind of nationalism based on capitalism, like America is exceptional because we have these great corporations.
It's also a cultural kind of nationalism, right? Because Americans are convinced that their culture is the best, right? Our music's the best, and so on, right? So, getting back to what I said about, you know, Americans traveling and seeing echoes of American culture in foreign lands, so that reassures them that American culture is so sexy and so attractive that everybody else can't help themselves, you know, embracing it and aping it. So they go home thinking, you know, well, we must be the best. You know, everywhere I go, people are, you know, are just infatuated with the American language, the American music, the American movies, etc. So that's, in a sense, that's our nationalism. You know, we are attached to these media products that are actually corporately controlled. You know what I'm saying? American pop music is not so much homegrown as what they want us to hear. So it's all, you know, especially the bigger act. You know, if you go to your local bar and you see some garage band, so that's different. But anything that's promoted on a national level or on an international level is definitely part of the bigger propaganda. But that's our nationalism. You know, we are attached to that, we are drawn to that, and we are loyal to that. And plus, we're drawn to symbols like the flag, right? And, you know, these stupid bumper stickers, you know, support the troops, right? We don't know where they've been sent to. We just support them anyway. But they're not fighting for us. They're not fighting for American interests. You know, they're fighting for the military banking complex and for Israel. They're fighting for people who are our enemies. You know, they're fighting for people who want us to destroy us. So when we support the troops, we are supporting our own destruction. So that has to stop. But, you know, but these slogans are so catchy and are so relentlessly pumped into us that we mouth these things mindlessly. I was in Wyoming, and I talked to a woman who had a daughter in South Korea, but she said my daughter is stationed in North Korea, and I couldn't, you know, I mean, she didn't even know where her daughter was. You know, so, I mean, that's how, I mean, look, I don't want to pick out that particular one, but that's, you know, we are that stupid sometimes. You know, we don't know where our children are being sent, you know. So, yeah, my daughter's stationed in North Korea.
In your series, Postcards from the End of America, are most of the people you chronicalize, are they people at the bottom of society, or do you chronicalize a lot of people from the declining middle class as well, or both?
I think I tend to gravitate to the poorest because those are the people I'm most comfortable with, you know, and that's the places I go to suit my budget. Okay, plainly as that. If I had more money, I'll go to nicer places and meet nicer people. You know, I'm not an academic. I've taught in a few schools. I never finished college. You know, I was a house painter before I published books. So, you know, and I was a house cleaner too. So, you know, I'm not a trained intellectual, so to speak. You know, I didn't go through the college system. I went through a few years of college, but I quit. So the people I interview, I talk to are people I've known all my life. Okay. Lately, I've done a series called Obscure Americans, where I interview someone at length, and I just let them talk. You know, and so that should come out as a book at some point. So these are just regular people. You know, your plumber. You know, your kitchen worker. I just interview a nun. You know, before I return to Saigon. So yeah, these are just regular people, and I allow them to talk at greater length. The postcards book was focused on places. The Obscure American book, if it comes out, will feature a bunch of individuals who are allowed to talk at length about themselves. And all these people have fascinating stories to tell, because no life is uninteresting.
Can you talk about your poetry and who been some of your major influences in your poetry?
Oh, you know, it's funny because my first few books were four of my first five books were poetry. So in a sense, I made a little name for myself as a poet. But I think I got frustrated with poetry because the audience is just so small, you know. And I don't think the general public has any interest in poetry at all. So I just realized, what am I doing? You know, I just felt that poets, American poets especially, need to find a way to address the larger issues and to talk to the larger public. And that's when I switched to writing political essays. As far as my favorite poet, without a doubt, Walt Whitman. You know, because he's the American ideal. He's not just the best American poet, period, by far. He's the American ideal. He articulated what this country should have been, could have been, but never quite become. You know, and I think you know, in five centuries, when the United States is only a memory, you know, it's only a footnote, you know, people would look to Walt Whitman as the embodiment, as the highest achievement of the country. Okay, it won't be our weapons, it won't be our buildings, it won't be anything else. It'll be Walt Whitman, because you know, he articulate what American should have been, what America should have been, and could have been.
Lyndon, it's been an excellent show. I'd like to thank you so much for being on.
Well, thanks for having me, Robert.